Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everyone, this is Gargi, and today I have with me Professor Kedar Kulkarni. He is Associate Professor of Literary and Cultural Studies at Flame University in Pune, India. He joins us today to talk about his book, World Literature and the Question of Genre in Colonial India, Poetry, Drama, and Print Culture, 1790 to 1890, published this year. Hello, Dr. Kulkarni, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me here. And, it's a pleasure to be here.
As always, I'd like to start with the genesis of this book. How did this book come to be? What were some initial ideas when you started writing this book?
Thank you. I think these are always very difficult questions to answer because genesis of books often take years. They can take the form of applying for graduate school, they can take the form of someone's dissertation, or they can be entirely different. When I started this project, it actually was a part of my dissertation. And somewhere along the line, I essentially scrapped the entire dissertation. There might be four pages that are similar to it in the book, but I essentially scrapped it. And what I decided to focus on was how to fit Marathi literature, which at the time was largely non-novelistic, was mostly performed, into a modern paradigm of world literature studies, or a contemporary paradigm of world literature studies. And so the genesis of this book, I would say, really emerged maybe around 2015, several years after I defended my dissertation, from the point of view of thinking through how colonialism really affects or transforms Indian literature. Of course, I can't deal with all of Indian literature. I can only deal with literature in the languages I know, which is Hindi and Marathi. And so I thought, let me actually look at Marathi literature and see how colonialism transforms it through its own processes, whether it's the implementation of print technology in colonial India, whether it's through reorganization of bureaucracy and education, and all these other questions that were actually classic post-colonial studies questions in the late 80s and early 90s, but I feel like never really permeated from the paradigm of English literature into the paradigm of Indian language literatures, such as Marathi, Hindi, Bengali, Oriya, Tamil, etc.
And the title of your book is World Literature and the Question of Genre in Colonial India. The question begs itself, why should genre be a subject of debate when you're talking about world literature?
That's a really important question, too. Different places in the world have different relationships to literature. And sometimes in situations such as India in the 19th century, literacy was so low in a kind of textual graphic literacy way that by 1911 in Sumit Sarkar's now classic book on modern India, 1% of the population was literate in English and 6% in Indian languages. And sure, that was a very powerful and influential sector of the population, but there's a whole other world out there beyond textuality. So when we think about it that way, classic studies in world literature, and I'm not the first person to make this claim, this is not my original claim, but this is not my original idea, but I do want to refine it a little bit, which is classic studies of world literature approach the novel as a genre. And despite a lot of literature on the novel in India, Meenakshi Mukherjee has several volumes of this, you can't get away from essentially what is Franco Moretti's claim that the novel is essentially an import from Europe to which other places in the world add their own content. Right, this kind of fundamental importation idea of the novel is pretty standard, and that's fine. Other genres have different relationships to colonialism. Amin Mufti talks about how the ghazal goes in reverse. The ghazal goes from essentially, you know, North Africa to South Asia, like this kind of this classic Oriental territory, to the West. Right, it travels in the reverse direction. But I think I also want to revise this idea of poetry being different from this importation model by saying that in South Asia, even poetry in the 19th century was a genre of performance. And the way I can explain this is, you know, there's this very famous movie starring Rekha from 1981 called Umrao Jaan. And in this, she is the highest rank of courtesan, Jaan, and she's trying to write a new song to perform to her patrons called Dil Cheez Kya Hai. It's a great number. It's fantastic, sung by Asha Bhosle. And she goes to an ustad and asks him to help her correct her poem. Now, the movie could end just there, or that scene could end just there. But the scene continues, and we actually see Rekha dance, albeit poorly, and you hear Asha Bhosle sing. And I always think about reading the poem versus hearing it sung and being danced out loud through this kind of scene in Umrao Jaan. What would it be like to actually be at a mehfil or be at a mushaira where people are speaking their poetry in a public setting rather than reading it privately in their room or privately through exchanging letters entirely like that? And so while obviously the critiques of the novel as a world literature genre are legion, and many of those critiques involve poetry, I think we can go a little bit step further from poetry and think about it as a genre of performance rather than the kind of new critical idea of poetry, which is reading something closely and textually to gain its meaning. That's why I think genre is a very significant aspect of this book.
Thank you for your answer. My second question is about the time period. You're talking about the long 19th century and Marathi literature during that period. And you have very specific time, for example, 1790 to 1890, that you mentioned even in the title of this book. Why did you choose this 100 years as a time period for your study?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the date, the exact 100 years is slightly arbitrary. But my main point in choosing this time period was to think about the before and during colonialism, right? One of the fun things about working on a place as large as South Asia is just how big and diverse and interesting it is. And one of those things that's interesting about it is colonialism is not a monolithic thing, even in South Asia. People often talk about the Battle of Plassey in 1757 as the kind of defining moment in which the East India Company gains a foothold in Bengal, right? But other parts of India don't come under colonial rule until much later, as late as 1837, if you think about Punjab, right? Late 1790s is Mysore of Tipu Sultan. The Marathas in the Anglo-Maratha Wars, 1803, 1818. So these all operate in different temporalities. And for me, of course, writing about Marathi literature, 1818 is a defining date at which the Peshwa is finally deposed and the Maratha Empire is essentially dissolved. And so I wanted to look before that date a little bit to think about what kinds of literary practices prevailed in the Maratha Empire, and then speak about how those practices changed throughout the course of the 19th century. And so change requires, of course, looking at a significant amount of time. You can't take your kind of synchronic view of things and think about how everything happened in 1840 or 1825 or whatever it may be. So I wanted to kind of do a little bit of both. I wanted to think about the long durée as well as, you know, look at the synchronic view as well. So in many of my chapters, I look at the synchronic view, but the whole book is directed towards this long durée arc of change, this narrative of change in Marathi literature.
And in your book, you're talking at several places for the need to bridge this gap between post-colonial studies and comparative literature. Why is there such a need?
That's a good question. I think, you know, when I was first a student in the early 2000s as an undergraduate, post-colonial studies was still hot. And but it was also the time when Spivak had just published her Critique of Post-Colonial Reason book. I think that's 2001 or 2002. And people were really into speaking still about Baba, about hybridity, about subalternity, Orientalism. These are still very relevant and topical kind of discourses. And they still remain with us. And they're really vital to the way we think about comparative literature, literary studies, let alone like disciplines like anthropology and stuff, which have also been greatly affected by the post-colonial turn. But by and large, if I look at some of the major and classic and defining studies of post-colonial literature, they mostly approach literatures in the English language. And part of that is an institutional problem in the Euro-North American Academy, which is post-colonial studies became institutionalized in English departments. And people weren't getting tenure for writing books on what's happening in Malayalam at the time, right? Whereas, conversely, comparative literature was also a discipline dominated by French, German, and Italian. Oh, sorry, French, German, and English. Italian and Romance languages are one thing. Slavic languages are another thing. And so, obviously, comparative literature as a discipline has changed significantly over the past 20, 25 years. And you can see this at major conferences like the ACLA, for example. There are a number of different panels on all sorts of languages from around the world. Whereas I think post-colonial studies, especially literary post-colonial studies, is still kind of stuck somewhere. And I wanted to bridge that gap by kind of making sure that there is room within post-colonial studies for the kinds of exciting approaches that scholars of post-colonial literature, scholars of comparative literature and world literature studies are doing. And so that bridging still needs to happen. I mean, I hope this will be occasion for more people to write about literatures other than English. I know that when you look at the job market, still Anglophone, 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 but I feel like there's more than that, you know, and there are a number of people who have done this. I think a colleague of mine did this, also published by Bloomsbury. I know Michael Allen has his book about Arabic and Egypt. And I think these texts are really shifting the ground in which we understand post-colonial studies in a colonial setting, and also the way minoritarian languages relate to majoritarian ones that are traditionally studied, like English, French, German.
And this is somehow also related to my next question, where in your book, you are seeking to redefine or reconsider the way the literature is conceptualized right now in the academia. So the first thing is, why is there a need to rethink literature as a concept, and how can we do that? I mean, what is it that we need to ask when we are reconceptualizing literature?
Yeah, I think, you know, something I think about is the way children grow up. And this is not limited to children, but I think this is a good example to use right now, which is all of the stories I heard growing up as a kid, whether it's from parents or grandparents or extended family, no one sat with me to read a book and tell these stories to me. I didn't learn nursery rhymes by reading a book either. And I think for a lot of people, oral literature and oral traditions are very strong. Even in my classes today here at Pune, India, I think my students are more from a talking culture than they are a reading culture. And I think once we account for that, not just in children's stories, but kind of outside of maybe major urban areas in South Asia, where, you know, things like, you know, that are called folk literature, for example, really have a lot more currency. In my environmental writing class, I wanted to teach a narrative by the Dhangar community, a folk narrative that's been translated by Anne Feldhaus recently. And I thought to myself, well, this might be difficult to teach, but then I Googled, and of course there's a YouTube video where you have some performers singing it, and I have the text right there. So I think expanding the notion of literature to think about orality and performance makes sense, and I think we have the tools now to do that. Whether it's folk literature or whether it's traditional Indian theater such as Kuriyattam or Kathakali, they're all on YouTube, they're all subtitled. And kind of bringing them in to the category of literature, I think is something that's actually the next frontier, because it takes you away from kind of these urban spaces, which are, of course, the cosmopolitan spaces where you have a very thin veneer of people circulating around the globe. A colleague of mine once told me this joke. He said whenever he leaves Pune, he thinks there are 600 people in the world. And then when he comes back to Pune, he's like, no, there are actually only 300 people in the world, and they all know each other. You know? And I think living in urban spaces, it's really different from living outside of urban spaces. And I think we have to account for that in a country like South Asia, where 70% of the people is still rural. 70% of the population is still rural, even though most of the news generated happens in urban areas, right? So what do people read? What is their kind of, what is their way of entertaining themselves when they're not at work or when they're not doing their chores or whatever it may be? And that takes you away from this kind of normative textual definition of literature. And we need to expand that for that reason. Because most people do use cell phones, most people do watch YouTube videos, and all of those things, tamasha, jatra, everything is available on YouTube to watch. And maybe in a class on world literature, there should be more kind of units on oral performance, oral narrative, or whatever it may be. The way I think about this in another sense is, you know, I feel like sometimes, and I'm an urban academic, so, you know, this critique applies to me too, which is sometimes we want to see a novel about the Dhungo community in the same way that we want to read Spivak's translations of Mahashweta Devi. Mahashweta Devi was a Brahmin woman from a literary family, and who walked through all the privileges that entailed, right? But there are also narratives by indigenous communities that we ought to read instead and think about them as literature rather than kind of shifting them to the side as folk literature or something that's traditional, etc. And so I do think the idea of literature as conceptualized today needs to be expanded, especially in a country like South Asia. And I can't speak for everywhere else, but this is my sense over here, that you can't just write or read literature through novels, poetry, or even theater for that matter, because a lot of performance doesn't happen in a theater.
Yeah. And coming back to performance, very early in the book, you're saying, and I'm quoting here, "Nowhere is there a clear display of performance genre and their interrelated and layered historical past than on theatrical wall posters." What does that mean?
I loved this funny thing I found at the archives, or these theatrical wall posters. They kind of essentially just advertisements glued to walls, and they have all sorts of, you know, they have all sorts of empirical data on them. Let's put it that way. The night of the performance, how long it'll last, how much ticket costs, who in what classes you can sit amongst men, women, behavior that's appropriate to being in a theater, etc. Like, all of these things are on the playbill, and they're really fascinating because I didn't just get one or two of them. I got about five or six of them, and some of them were earlier and some of them were later. So some of them are from the early 1870s and some of them are from the late 1880s. And in that 20 year time period, there's a massive change that you see in the way printers use typography, in the way the imagery works on the playbills, and the kinds of performances you see on there as well. These were like my entryway into this whole project. And I wrote about them more in my first article, which I'm obviously, like, you know, like everyone else, I have some kind of embarrassment when I look at my first article. And I can't believe I wrote it. But they were my entryway into this wider world, which let me really see into the past as well as the present day, and think about historical change. So one of the fun things when you look at these playbills, the earlier versus the later ones, is the earlier playbills are generally not about a single performance that takes the whole night to perform. They are about performing many different episodes, and each of those episodes has a very different kind of emotional valence or emotional register. Some of them are about Shingar or Eros. Some of them are about, like, disgust. There's a scene in one of them that's mentioned about disemboweling and the stomach bursting. I wish I could recover a description of these where you could actually see what's happening. You know, how do they do that? How do they stage that? That'd be amazing to see that. But unfortunately, I don't. But I have a number of layered kind of emotions and sensibilities that you're supposed to feel watching this. And there are a number of genres. There are akhyans, there are charitras, There are farces. So you have these different genres. You have different emotional registers that you're supposed to feel. And in the later ones, you don't. In the later ones, you'll see an integrated play, like one play, whether it's Shakuntala, Sangeet Saubhadra. This is, of course, middle-class drama. A lot of the stuff from the earlier plays remains, but it doesn't necessarily remain. It changes. I don't want to say it's completely gone, but it changes. And in the later playbills, what you see are like a unified, integrated performance of one play. And that play may take 2 days to perform, but it's one play. And that change, to me, is significant between a kind of variety-type show versus a singular show, where you're supposed to feel many different things, to something that has like one primary emotion, but has several secondary emotions attached to it. The biggest change for me is also on the prices, especially for women to attend the performance. Earlier playbills, for women, they say gartis, which is family women, or they say nayakinis and kasbinis. Nayakinis and kasbinis are female performing artists. Whereas later playbills for the female performing artists just say vesha or prostitutes. And this change in which women performers are recoded as prostitutes is a fundamentally interesting change for me, because it speaks to middle-class sensibilities to evacuate the theatrical space of all sorts of sexual transactions. It speaks to changes in how the middle class saw performers in general. And of course, there's a historical corollary, which is the Contagious Diseases Acts of the late 1860s really pauperized many of the kinds of performers that might have earned a living from, I don't want to say, you know, courtesan culture. I mean, there are a number of articles on courtesan culture in India during this time, in which the performance can lead to a sexual transaction of some point after a certain amount of patronage or whatever it may be. But these acts, of course, change the nature of female performance in colonial India. And you see that registering on the playbill itself, in the categorical change from a performing artist such as a Nayakini or Kasbini to a performing artist who is just labeled Vesha. So you see all sorts of references to the past and present, genre, emotion, reception, behavior, sexuality, all on the playbills. And they were so eye-opening because they're right there and no one's spoken about them. So I was like, oh my God, I have to speak about this because this is such a great source. And I was so lucky to be able to include them in the book as well.
And if I may digress a little, why was this change happening? For example, the first change that you were talking about, from many different parts of the show to one play, which was going over, let's say, for 2 days. Why did this change happen? Is this colonialism working in the sense that people are reading theaters, getting exposed to the European theater? Is that one of the reasons, or do you think this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important reason. I try to circumvent this question of influence versus rupture in my book, which is to what extent are Indian literatures formed on the basis of rupture, and to what extent are they continuous with their pre-colonial past? And I think there are elements of both in that. But what I'd say is, in throughout the 1850s onwards, and even before that, well, not so much before that, but after the 1850s, you have these big colonial circuits for theatrical troupes to follow. So they, you know, might leave somewhere in the UK and then come down the coast, go through Egypt. Did they go through Egypt? I don't know if the Suez Canal was built at that point. Maybe not. Go around the Cape of Good Hope, you know, stop off at every colonial port city, you know, Bombay, somewhere in Sri Lanka, Calcutta, then go on to Singapore, all the way down to Australia and back. They're doing these long circuits and they're performing a repertoire of large plays. And all of the students that start, the middle-class students, essentially, that start this musical theater tradition in Marathi, they're watching these plays and they're adopting this dramaturgy, even though a lot of the content of their plays may remain based on the Ramayana or the Mahabharata or something like that. So they are adapting this dramaturgy. Like, you can see a perfect five-act dramatic structure in many of these plays, right? And so I think that idea of carrying an emotion to a climax and letting it fall towards the end is not necessarily an Indian notion, right? But I think that is a large influence on why theater moves from this multifarious experience to a singular one, is partially to talk about civility and so show yourself as civilized in some ways, right? I speak about this a little bit in chapter 3 with reference to Shakuntala and talk about how theater and playing in the theater was a form of showing yourself as civilized at this time for the middle-class audience. I also speak a little bit about this same issue in one of my articles about slavery and performance in South Asia, where I talk about middle-class moralistic discourse that tries to evacuate all of these disgusting or extra-erotic moments from the theater over the course of the 19th century. So I think they're both. It's part moralistic, it's part wanting to show yourself as civilized, it's part kind of adopting this dramaturgy that you see. The Bandaman Company, I believe, is a really important company that goes all over the world and actually perform Shakespeare all over the world. So there are a number of other theatrical companies. There's a dissertation published on this many years ago called English Drama on the Bombay Stage that I wish someone had found the means to publish this in the form of a book, because it has a lot of great, it's one of the first works that really deals with this topic in such a archivally rich way. And she talks about this kind of theatrical troupes moving, God, I forget her name right now, moving around the world and kind of essentially not teaching dramaturgy, but having local audiences adapt that kind of dramaturgy as well.
And coming back to the question of post-colonialism and world literature, you say that the disruption of colonization in South Asia transformed Marathi literature from panchronic to vernacular ecology. What does that mean?
Okay, so when I wrote this book, I was trying to ride two horses at once. In the first case, I was self-consciously writing through established paradigms in world literature studies that see models of competition, recognition, technology, and progress, essentially capitalism, that come with that as a kind of commodity, and literature as a kind of commodity designed to be exchanged, right? But more recently, Alexander Beecroft's work and Ecology of World Literature instead speaks of literature ecologically, using the metaphors from biology instead. And rather than assigning everything an exchange value that is determined by a cash amount and somehow being able to form equivalents, like, you know, the mouse of my computer cost me $5 and the pencil case I have also costs $5, so they're equivalent in value. Ecologies doesn't actually attribute that kind of equivalence to literary texts or to things in nature, because they all serve a specific function, right? They're not exchangeable in the same ways. I can't ask you, hey, would you rather read this novel or would you rather go watch a performance of Tamasha? I think you might have your preferences, but those two things are incomparable. There's no cash value that you can assign to them that really allows them to be compared properly. And I think that model of ecology was very valuable to the way I think about literature. And Beecroft especially thinks about a number of different literary ecologies, one of which is a panchoric ecology. And for him, the classical model for that is a Greek city-states. You have all of these different city-states in ancient Greece that kind of have a shared culture, but they don't have kind of a political center in the same way. And when I thought about Marathi literature in the 18th century, it was kind of like that. It's very political to say whether it's a Maratha empire or whether it's a Maratha confederacy, because over the course of the late 17th and all of the 18th century, all of the kind of local potentates that comprise the Maratha empire, whether it's the Gaikwads of Baroda, the Bhosles of Nagpur, et cetera, they essentially develop significant dominions and capabilities of their own. So and even though they're loosely allied to the Peshwa of Pune. So this kind of metaphor of panchoric ecology, where you have a shared kind of Marathi-speaking culture, they're patronizing the same poets, the same kinds of literatures, but at the same time, their alliance is always being negotiated and renegotiated. And so I thought it was a good metaphor to use for Marathi literature at this time period too, a panchoric ecology where their political center is not so strong, but the regional center is kind of subscribed to this similar kind of model of patronage, etc. Now, what Beecroft says is a panchoric ecology can become a cosmopolitan one with a stronger pan-regional kind of influence. And he talks, of course, about Hellenism of Alexander the Great. Okay, and so I thought Marathi literature at this time was kind of aspiring to that at the moment, right? Marathi was used as an administrative language all the way from Peshawar all the way down to Arcot. This is a huge part of India that is using Marathi language for administrative purposes. But it never became cosmopolitan because the Maratha Empire collapsed. Rather, what happened is it saw itself in relationship to a new cosmopolitan language, English. Whereas before it had seen itself in relationship to Sanskrit, now it also saw itself in relationship to English. And so rather than going from panchoric to cosmopolitan, it went from panchoric to vernacular. It was re-inscribed within a regional setting rather than becoming a cosmopolitan thing. So these ideas, I mean, obviously I use them metaphorically. I'm not using them in a super precise way, but there are certain ideas that are evocative that help us understand these historical transformations. And so when it went from panchoric to vernacular, I'm really relying on Alexander Beecroft's work to kind of distance myself a little bit from the economic models that are so prevalent in literary studies.
Coming to chapter three, you're talking about the play, everyone's favorite play, Shakuntala, and you're saying Shakuntala is an Oriental text. As an Oriental text, played a significant role in the way Indian literature was conceptualized and understood in foreign locales. Can you elaborate on what that means?
I can. I just want to go back to the earlier question for one last comment, which is one of the hallmarks of a vernacular literature, according to Beecroft, is that it borrows a lot from cosmopolitan literatures. So when you asked me about why these playbills show one play instead of many things, I think this idea of borrowing from all these theater troupes that are going in, I think ideas of translations from Sanskrit and English into Marathi, these are all kind of the hallmarks of a vernacular literary ecology. And so I just wanted to underline that part a little bit. Your question of Shakuntala, yes. It was an Oriental text in the sense that, you know, after it was translated, so William Jones, I think, first translated into Latin and then into English. I don't remember the exact kind of process, but after it was translated, it kind of, it blew up a little bit. Goethe commented on it, Herder commented on it, you know, Victor Hugo, etc. There are a host of European intellectuals, romantic thinkers who commented on Shakuntala. And like something like the Arabian Nights, it became one of these kind of focal points on how to understand India. Right? James Mill is the senior is James Mill, John Stuart is a younger, but one of them also commented on it. And it becomes this kind of larger than life text that it's kind of metonymic. It is the text that stands in for the entire society. It's like saying, oh, you want to understand England? Look at Shakespeare. You want to understand, I don't know, France? Look at Victor Hugo. Right? It's like the text that really comes to define literature in South Asia for a while. And so themes about pastoralism, princely license, the idea of Shakuntala as first a wild maiden who is kind of beautiful and in nature, but then by the end of the century, as times change, she becomes the image of a fallen woman, you know? So it comes up and resurfaces throughout the 19th century as a way to understand relationships between princes, their people, between women and sexuality, etc. And that's why I call it kind of like this Oriental text that really plays a strong role in understanding India. But I don't do that. I situate it in India as a performance. So it's not about everything outside of India and how India is understood through Shakuntala, but it's how Shakuntala actually works within an Indian context.
And how does it work within the Indian context?
Well, I mean, all of these things are very regional and very kind of, you know, the fun thing about the Shakuntala chapter for me is that it resonates directly with some court cases between princes and their kind of tutors. So throughout the 19th century, the East India Company had this policy of giving princely states a Brahmin tutor to train the prince in order to kind of make the prince knowledgeable in modern political science, essentially, in modern statecraft. is probably a better word than political science, statecraft. And you see this in a number of different princely states. And sometimes those relationships weren't very willing. They weren't very accommodating. And there's a lot of friction between them. So you see that relationship a little bit enacted in the way people talk about this play in the Indian press at the time. Because there is one really important case in 1880 where the Maharaja of Kolhapur, I think, has an argument, and a newspaper sues this guy named Vasudeva Vaman Barve about the way he tutored him and all this other stuff. And that really gets refracted through the play of Shakuntala. One also sees the Contagious Diseases Acts and the way performing women were kind of displaced and turned into common prostitutes. I think that can also be filtered through our understanding of Shakuntala and the way the figure of the fallen woman kind of, the way Shakuntala becomes a figure of a fallen woman by the end of the century. So all of these things, I kind of really historically situated. I talk about patronage, the way princes patronize Brahmins, the way the colonial government patronizes their new middle class Brahmin employees, etc. So it's filtered through all these registers of caste, class, sexuality, and I really try to do a micro history of the play from about 1882 to maybe 1890. Some of the sources are really fun. That was a really fun chapter to write. Like the letters between the government officials and the students saying like, "Oh, you performed the play so well," blah blah blah. It's so patronizing, and it's fantastic. Sorry, I'm supposed to give a plug for myself. I really enjoyed writing this chapter.
Yeah. And coming to the second play, which is Sangeet Saubhadra, Subhadra becomes Saubhadra, you say that it created and projected a totalizing authorial discourse. How does it do that?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about how the playbills have this kind of singular playbill in the later ones where you have one play as opposed to many different plays. And whenever I think about an authorial discourse, I think about Mikhail Bakhtin, who is kind of the preeminent theorist of an authorial discourse. And his main thing is an authorial discourse is one that has the ability to unify many different narrative voices from their kind of disuniting tendencies. So obviously, as a Marxist, these narrative voices are emblematic of different classes in society, and they're in conflict with each other. And what an authorial discourse does is allow the reader to see all of these different kinds of class conflict coexisting in that shared space. Now, if we think about that idea, I use that to talk about genre in Kirloskar's play, Sangeet Saubhadra, which is you have different Indian performance genres that he kind of brings into the body of this play. So you see launis, you see powaras, you see a number of different kinds of verse forms from Marathi literature. And and these are all used in their specific contexts. No one's you know, singing a launi any time of day. No one's singing a powara any time of day. They're designed for specific reasons and rationales in the performance traditions of that area. And he manages them to put them all into the space of the play, have different characters sing these verse numbers. And that idea, if you take a narrative voice at the level of genre, I say Kirloskar is the master creator of an authorial discourse out of these many different poetic genres. So the narrative voice becomes a genre in my analysis, and Kirloskar obviously still remains the author, but he unites these different poetic registers that wouldn't always share the same textual space in the same way. Maybe in a night's performance, they might go from A to Z and kind of have different kinds of genres performed, but to see that they are embodied in that same textual space to me is very interesting.
And coming to the last notion that I want to talk about is the notion of the gift. And if I have understood what you're saying correctly, is that you're saying that it's important to not only look from the gift of theory from the perspective of the Europeans who are the receiving, but also from the perspective of the South Asians who are projected to be giving this gift. And if my interpretation is correct, how can this theory of gift be understood from the South Asian perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think about exchange. So I'm not going to go into like traditional theories of gift-giving. I'm not interested in Marcel Mauss or Levi Strauss or even Derrida's idea of the free gift over here. What I am interested in is kind of thinking about exchange, right? Gifting isn't a one-way street. It's not just something the Europeans give and the Indians receive with their arms wide open and saying, thank you for this gift, right? It goes in both directions. And for me, the biggest gift is the gift of theory that comes from the engagement with not just South Asia, but with other colonies around the world. Many of our dominant, like, you know, this is Derrida's critique of ethnology, of Levi-Strauss, which is ethnology as a discipline only exists because you confront the fact that, well, I mean, Europeans confront the fact that their ideas are not universal, right? And so ethnology as a discipline is kind of a gift from the colonies to the center. We have other ways of thinking about this. I spoke about Gaudi Vishwanathan a lot in my book. The English curriculum is a curriculum that's developed in the colonies for civilizing the natives. And then this is exported back to England to civilize the lower classes, right? This is another kind of gift. People talk about criminology in terms of like fingerprinting and all these other methods that are also developed in South Asia and then sent back to the metropole to kind of use on their own population. So the idea of the colony being a laboratory is very, very well established. But I wanted to look at one specific gift that I thought was especially significant that people had maybe occasionally mentioned here or there, but they hadn't really explored in depth. And that to me was through the figure of Saussure. Saussure, obviously, we all know, everyone has to read him either as an undergrad or as a grad student. He is like the granddaddy of literary studies in the 20th century, because if you don't read Saussure, you don't know anything that comes after him. You don't know Levi-Strauss. You don't know Derrida. You probably don't even know J.L. Austin very well. You don't know. I mean, there's so many aspects of his linguistic theory. There are aspects of his linguistic theory that touch upon everything from formalism to deconstruction. And that's just how it is. He's the foundational figure. But when you read about him, or when you read him, there's no context ever given for him. So if you read Foucault, you have to read Nietzsche before him. You have to read Althusser before you read Foucault, because Foucault's biopolitics is essentially Althusser's RSAs and ISAs reinvented in a post-Marxist kind of way. But with Saussure, there's no such thing required. And I was like, well, how is it possible that this guy who wrote his PhD on the genitive case in Sanskrit and how to use it, how is it this guy who lectured for 30 years about the Sanskrit language invents this theory of language that is kind of so, seems so ex nihilo? And when I was reading through some of my archives, I realized, and some of my texts, I realized that this idea of difference in terms of words not actually referring to the objects themselves, but referring to other words around them through exclusion, is actually a very Buddhist view of language. And it's called the Apoha, specifically the Apoha theorized by people like Dignaga and Bhatrahari. I don't know if Bhatrahari is Buddhist, but it's specifically something that's a Buddhist view of language against a Brahminical understanding of language, in which if you are reciting a Vedic mantra, the speaking of which is supposed to change reality. Well, for the Buddhists, speaking is meaningless unless it's through processes of exclusion. And I think this fundamental difference between Buddhist and Brahminical ideas of language is the kind of thing that Saussure is picking up on. If you read his, and beyond that, if you read his course in general linguistics, he has a diagram for where sounds come out of your mouth, from the back of your throat to your lips. And I feel like when I was reading that the first time, I thought to myself, you know, when we learn to recite the English alphabet, we learn A, B, C, D, E, F, G, or in French, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And it's the same thing, but it has nothing to do with where the sounds come from in your mouth. But if you're learning Devanagari, it's ga, ka, ga, 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 cha, 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 cha. And Saussure could only have understood that if he had read Panini's grammar, Ashtadhyayi. Like, there's no other way in which he would have understood that. And I wanted to really fill this gap in this connection and give Saussure a genealogy, one that kind of lets us see, well, listen, the foundational assumptions of so many thinkers are not Saussurean. They're actually Buddhist or Brahminical. And we have to really pay attention to that genealogy, because that is a huge gift of theory that comes directly from the colonies to the colonizer. So something like J.L. Austin's idea of performative language is so profoundly Brahminical and Vedic. One wonder, like, what after all is a performative utterance? Something uttered within specific contexts and with specific intentions. What is that if not ritual language spoken to alter reality? So for me, when I thought about the gift, it was this gift of theory from the colonies to the colonizer. And, you know, the way I thought about this, another way to think about it is many years ago, I was in a class where the professor was lecturing about the later Roman Empire, and he was lecturing about St. Augustine of Hippo, which is essentially in Libya. And he spoke, you know, he said something really interesting to me. And I think at this point, this is about 10 years ago, I think postcolonial studies had finally started reaching classical studies at this point. And he said, in the later Roman Empire, a lot of Roman culture starts to be defined from the peripheries of Rome. And the colonies, in this sense, are the peripheries that are defining the colonial center at this point, especially through their ideas.
Since we're at the end of the podcast, I have one last question for you. What do you hope the readers take from this book?
That's a great question. There are two big takeaways from this book. The first one is, I think I'd like to say that deconstructing hegemonic systems only goes so far if there's no dearth of alternative visions afterwards. And, you know, for example, with my deconstruction of Saussure, I also provide an alternative history for this to happen. And so I want my book to be seen as an alternative history of how literature changes through the colonial encounter. I think that to me is very important. I re-narrate the story of Marathi literature by placing it within a world system, both economic and ecological. And I respond to post-colonial scholarship and Marathi scholarship on ruptures and continuity to make my claim. So part of my critique is almost a foundational critique, a deconstruction, but there's also a history, there's also a literary history, a rewriting, a historical revision that makes amends and provides a course correction. And secondly, I think my second big takeaway is forget about English, right? I mean, obviously I'm not the first person to say this, but I think the logic of the university press, the North American University Press, is such that it doesn't take risks anymore, even though that's what it was designed to do, is to publish risky works that wouldn't find mainstream media publication, right? So I would say India is not monolingual. And no matter how much you speak about English or how sophisticated you make your argument about English, there are at least 25 other official languages in India, let alone hundreds of other lesser known ones. So please take away the idea of the vernacular from this book as a site where real exchange happens, as a site where critique happens, and as a real source of ideas.
And I'm not I think it's a little bit too early to ask, but I think you can still answer this question, is what are you working on right now? What can we hope to read from you in the future?
I am working on a project right now called Animal Aesthetics, Rereading the Non-Human in South Asia. And it's my step away slightly from a historicist and archival methodology. And I instead speak broadly about the environment and animals in literature, film, art, past and present, and in multiple Indian languages. I can't give away more than that because I don't know what it's about entirely yet. But, I hope I'll get to speak with you again in 4 years. And if not, maybe another grad student like you who's also doing this podcast, which is really fun to be on. So thank you for having me here.
Well, I hope I'm still doing it in the next 4 years and meet you again. But thank you. That does sound like a fascinating project, and I hope to read this book soon from you. Thank you for taking the time out to talk to me.
Thank you for having me.